I have the special privilege now to introduce to you Jeff Lilly, Executive Director of Hume Lake Christian Camps. And I can't mention Hume Lake Christian Camps without saying that in 1977 I asked a man that was on the board, I said, couldn't you do something for firefighters? They had a policeman's conference, and so he said, I'll check with them. And so that year, we had, I think, 60 people showed up that first in 1977 for the first firefighters conference. And they've done a conference every year since. And it's a life-changing time. And I'm telling you, if you have the opportunity, set apart the first weekend of April. It used to be in November. Don't get confused with that. Now it's the first weekend of April. And how many of you people have been to Hume Lake for a firefighters conference? All right. So let's work on having everyone be there this next April. They always have great speakers. They have music like John, and well, not maybe all that good, but they have good music. Because it doesn't get much better than that. But Jeff was a guy that that went to wagon train up there. That's where the kids during the summer stay in covered wagons. I know when our first year that our little grandkids went there, the bear came in the wagon train and ate their goodies. And, of course, all of my granddaughter was scared her to death. But anyway, all the way from 8 years old, they have a wagon train, and they have Meadow Ranch, and then they have high school camp. They have about 2,000 total per week up there that they minister to. And Jeff heads that whole thing up. I don't know how you do it. It's you don't either. He's shaking his head. I don't have a clue. I understand how that works. If God doesn't do it, it doesn't get done. So Jeff, come up and share what's on your heart. He's just a special, special brother. And his wife, Eugenia, is here with him. Eugenie, forgive me. I get Eugenie. Jeff.
Thank you, John. You know, what's fun is 77, when Firefighters for Christ started up there, I started in 1980 working at Hume in the kitchen. And I was washing dishes and flipping pancakes, doing that type of thing. And during the break times, we'd have to go out and clear the tables. And as I'd clear the tables, I saw the Firefighters for Christ table off to the side with all the tapes and T-shirts, that kind of a thing. And I was just a really young man and was working away. And so I picked up one of those brochures that had the thing where you could get free tapes. And I, you know, Hume, you really, when you work on Hume's salary, you can't even afford free. But at least it kind of got your attention. And so I saved up till I was able to do that and order some of those tapes. But those tapes were instrumental in the early development of my faith and being able to shape me, because at Hume, you don't necessarily even have church. It's a long ways away. We do now, but at that time we didn't. And so you guys don't realize it, but those Firefighters for Christ tapes became my pastor, my wife's pastor, and challenged us enough to go back to Bible college and to get into ministry. And so it's been a really cool thing. So it's a warm feeling to come to you and just say, hey, thanks for having us, because you've played a role in our life and in many, many other lives. In fact, as we're talking about tapes, just for a second, if you guys haven't listened to Russell Kelfer on Proverbs, you got to get that series. It's a big series, but he is very, very good on the book of Proverbs. You got to do it. Just a godly, godly man. But enough on that. My name is Jeff, and my wife Eugenia is here, and we're just thrilled to be with you. We have five children, two boys and three girls, and I am sorry for you, because they are the most beautiful kids in the world, and that means yours are less than, and it's just unfortunate for you. But we also have four grandchildren, and just the Lord has blessed us. I know some of you are going, no, he doesn't have grandkids, he's too young, but we got married at 13, and it's... we have been married for 26 years, almost 27, and the Lord has just blessed us, and we've been having a great time. But what I want to do this morning is kind of walk through a little bit of some things that I've been learning in my life, but specific about you guys, because what's happened is that as I look at life, I watch certain people that become heroes of ours. And there's no question that the firefighters are number one on the list. You guys have it. Whenever they do a survey, the number one most respected, most trusted person, job, that kind of thing, is firefighters. Now, when you know some of them, they're also pretty tricky. So I'm not sure about that trusted part. They, you know, they threatened to throw Eric in the lake. I mean, what's up with that, you know? Oh, it's not a threat. It's a promise. Well, you're going to have to carry that out so you can make sure we keep this trust up. How many would agree that you need to throw Eric in the lake? All right. So let's be men of our word, all right? Let's do that. So, anyway, what I want to do is I want to stop and focus on that idea of how you're trusted. And this is literally, this happened yesterday. We were getting ready to come down here, and so I was going through this, and, you know, you got to pay bills, and election times come up, and because we live in Hume, we do that permanent absentee ballot, so you can always vote that way. So I was throwing all the election stuff in to determine who there might be left to vote for. But as I was getting the materials together, there were so many different flyers on the different propositions, and I was amazed that clearly more than half of them had pictures of firefighters on them. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but you guys are supporting Proposition 93, but you're also against Proposition 93. You guys are for Propositions 94, 95, 96, and 97, and you're also against 94, 95, 96, 97. Sometimes it's a picture of one of you guys all sweaty and sooty, and other times, I kid you not, sometimes it's just your legs. Is that right, Eugenie? There are pictures on this stuff that's going across the state for voter initiatives that just show the pant legs and the boots of firefighters, and that's enough to carry the bill. Just your feet. You guys are phenomenal. You don't believe me? Go look at your mail. It is there. But that's the trust and respect that we have for you because of your commitment, because of what you put on the line. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for what you do every day. But I want to say thank you from Hume as well, because you have been such a part from our volunteer weeks. When you guys come up, we can have carpenters come up, and typically we have to fix what they did over the week. But then we have you guys come up in Wildwood. How many of you got a chance to actually build Wildwood? Yeah, many of you are here that built a camp that right now is making sure kids are getting into the kingdom and a part of ministry later on. So just thank you for all that. I want to kind of weave a couple of issues through this morning. One of them is regards my son. My oldest son, his name is Noel, and Noel went on in his life. He had a dream to someday be a U.S. Army Ranger, Special Operations. And when he first came and told us, he said, "Dad, I want to be a ranger." And I'm thinking, Park Service? You know, that's interesting. You know, we grew up in the mountains. That makes sense. And he goes, "No, Dad, and a U.S. Army Ranger." I had no clue what that really was. I had some image in the back of my mind that it had something to do with Special Forces, but I didn't know much about it. So we started to read about it. And as we read more and more about it, we started to think, you know, maybe we need to start kind of softening the blow, because it's very difficult to get into the Rangers. And there's a lot of people who try, but most people don't make it. In fact, we looked at it and said, this is a kid that, frankly, right now, we can't get him to make his bed. How in the world is he going to be disciplined enough to make it into a unit like that? And so we were trying to prepare him for that, but he stopped and he called me and he said, "Dad, what I want to do is move back home, and I want to spend the 3 months just working out, getting in shape so that I can make it. But I also need to know that my spiritual life is solid as well. And I'd like to just spend the mornings in Bible study with you, if that's all right." Well, as a dad, you know, of course you're going to say no to that. I got my morning situation laid out. It's like, there's no time for that. And it was humbling to have your son come back and to say that thing. Well, we spent the summer doing that and working hard and getting in shape and getting him ready spiritually as well. Even talking about politics and why we were at war. And all of those things preparing him to go off to try this thing. Well, he did. He went off, went through boot camp. And if you're going to be a ranger, you have to volunteer 4 different times. You have to volunteer for the service. You have to volunteer for airborne. You have to volunteer through what's called RIP, or Ranger Indoctrination Program. And you have to volunteer every time that you go into battle. And those 4 times, they said, "We don't ever want to draft you. We don't ever want to force you. If you show up, it's because you want to be there." I think you understand that. You understand the risk that's on the other side, and you don't go because someone tells you. You go because you have a deep conviction about being there. And so he went through the program and went through the airborne and then went through the Ranger indoctrination program. And that program, tough, they had 134 guys that get thinned out, culled out. And then finally they get 134 guys that are going to go in and say, I want to be a Ranger. And of that, when we got there on graduation day, there were 16 guys that made it. And there was our son, the same boy who couldn't make his bed, same boy who wouldn't clean his room. But somehow something tripped inside of him and he said, I'm doing this. He went on and went through all the training that they do with the Rangers, and he went on to two tours in Iraq and one tour in Afghanistan. But I have to tell you one particular story that's my favorite story. The first time they got into combat in Iraq, my son, who is what's called a fire support specialist, that means he calls in the airstrikes or artillery and gets additional things there, so he always has a radio with him. And so he carries a radio wherever he goes so that the commander, the captain, those kind of guys can get a hold of somebody, or if they need to call in support, my son knows how to make sure that if he had a radio and if we, you know, we're in another country, we wouldn't be safe in this room. He could pinpoint this room, that kind of a thing. That's what he's trained for. Well, they're out on this mission at night, and as they go in, they surround this one compound, and he comes up against this one wall with a couple of other guys, and their job is to cover this one sector. And so they're there against this wall, and they get into a firefight. There's bullets flying left and right, and they know that there's a couple of guys down the street that are hidden behind something, and they've got a bead on them, and they're just shooting away. Well, the Rangers, one of the benefits for them is they have night vision goggles. So they're able to put on the night vision, and that allows them to be pretty much invisible to everybody else, but they can see anybody else that's out there. The problem in this case is there's a street light right above them. And the street light is fully lighting them up. Their night vision is worthless, and they're lit up, these guys right against the wall. And so these insurgents are shooting right at them, and the bullets are hitting everywhere, and they're stuck on this wall. They can't leave their position, or they abandon the rest of the mission of what's happening inside. But they're pretty much stuck right there. It's a bad situation. So my son is on the radio trying to call in a Bradley fighting vehicle. It's got some machine guns on it that maybe if he could come down the road, it could take these guys out and that would work. In the meantime, the two guys that he's with are trying to shoot out the street light. Because if we're exposed by the light, let's take out the light. Then they don't know where we're at. That's really good thinking. That's why they're Rangers. The problem is that my son's on the radio trying to get this situation taken care of, and his buddies are taking these shots at the streetlight, and they're not knocking out the light. This streetlight, my son says, he's going, it's 18 feet away. This thing is 18 feet away, and they can't hit it. To be a Ranger, you have to train and qualify as an expert marksman. Anything less, and you're not a Ranger. It's just that simple. If you can't use that gun like an expert, you're not in. Here's two expert marksmen. They cannot take out the light. Finally, my son puts down the radio and says, oh, for crying out loud. He picks up his weapon, points it at the street light and tap, tap. Shoots twice. And he says, Dad, those are the only two shots I ever fired in Iraq. And Dad, I missed. You missed. And he says, yeah, what we realized, because it was our first combat, we were so jittery that we had our sights and everything. We were putting the sights right on it. And he says, but our sights are set for like 200 yards. Up close, we're trained to shoot from the hip. We can shoot running. We can do anything. But you never look at the sights when you're up close. We're that good. Meanwhile, behind the fence, one of the other Special Forces guys goes over to the generator, and the light goes out. Those are the two shots my son fired in Iraq. Well, the reason I start with that story is because you guys are mighty men and women who have committed. You understand that commitment. You understand that risk. And in Scripture, there are those men listed as well. And so I'm going to tell you a bit of a story, read to you part of it, but it's out of Chronicles. And in the story of Chronicles, there are several times when it talks about mighty men and great men. This particular part, as we begin, it talks about these men that are known as the Gadites. And it's one of those names you don't normally want to be known as. You know, it's just one of those words that are strange. But listen to what it says about the Gadites. These Gadites were officers of the army. The least was a match for 100 men. The least of them The weakest of them, the smallest of them, the least of them was a match for 100 men. Take on 100 guys, one guy. That was the least of the Gadites. And that's the concept. He was the least. The least was a match for 100 men and the greatest for 1,000. These are the men who crossed the Jordan in the first month when it was overflowing all its banks and put to flight all those in the valleys to the east and the west. So the least of them will take on 100. The greatest will take on 1,000. And they attack, even if it's a wintertime and a flood, they go over through the river and put everybody else to flight on the other side. These guys are pretty tough. These are men that come to David. We'll talk about that in a second. But the men that were already with David are mighty men. And as you look at the story of these men, it comes through and it talks about different guys. One of my favorite is a man named Eleazar. He's the son of Dodo. And that's probably how he got tough right there. Is, you know, your dad's Dodo. Yeah. Anyway, he was with David at Pas Damon. When the Philistines were gathered there for battle, there was a plot of ground full of barley, and the men fled from the Philistines. The whole army abandons and runs, except for Eleazar. He took his stand in the midst of the plot and defended it and killed the Philistines. In fact, in another passage, it talks about how the whole army went away, and Eleazar stood there and fought until pretty soon there was no one left. They came back and thought, what happened? Here's all the Philistines dead around him and Eleazar. And they had to pry the sword from his fingers. That's how hard he fought and the conviction that he gave. These are mighty men. These are great and mighty things. One other guy is Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant man. He was a doer of great deeds. He struck down two heroes of Moab. He also went down and struck down a lion in a pit on a day when snow had fallen. And he struck down an Egyptian, a man of great stature, 5 cubits tall. The Egyptian had in his hand a spear like a weaver's beam. But Benaiah went down to him with a staff, snatched it out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him. By the way, 5 cubits is 7.5 feet tall. To go into a pit with a lion on a snowy day is a day when you don't want to be outside anyway. But a slippery sides, this lion somehow gets caught in the pit. Nobody's going to deal with it. The issue is, if you wait until the snow melts, the lion's going to come get you. Benaiah says, we're not waiting for that. And he jumps into the pit and deals with the issue at hand. There's something different about mighty men. They don't wait for things to happen. They jump in and make it happen. So when I look at a room like this, I go, these are mighty men. These are mighty women. These are men and women who have committed their life to be these kind of people. And I love that about you. But there's another thing about you that sometimes is troubling. But it's not just you, it's every person. It tends to be more true of mighty people, though. Because you can rely on your strength, it becomes a resource for you that you feel pretty confident about things in life. That's where you get into trouble with me, because I have the mic. And I get a chance to talk about this for a second. This story of the mighty men is tucked between two battlefields. The first battlefield Saul fights, the second battlefield David fights. The first battle, Saul has got his army, he is doing well, he is king of all of Israel. He's got his sons with him, he's got his own mighty men. And as he's fighting, he's doing his thing, he's a strong, strong leader. But something happens in the battle to where the battle turns and his men go, you know what, we're not winning this thing, we're toast, and so they split. They begin this retreat and they run away from the battlefield. Saul and his sons continue to fight, but they get overrun until they're onto what's called Mount Gilboa. Now the Philistines fought against Israel and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and mistreat me. But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died. Thus Saul died. He and his three sons and all his house died together. And when all the men of Israel who were in the valley saw that the enemy had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled. And the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they stripped him and took his head and his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to their idols and to the people. And they put his armor in the temple of their gods and fastened his head in the temple of Dagon. Now, that's pretty gruesome. But I want you to see how far this man has fallen. The king of Israel comes to a point to not only does he lose the battle, but it's such a bad day that his men retreat, leaving him behind. He's there with his sons. He watches his sons die. He then gets injured by arrows, but he's not yet dead. This is a bad, bad day. Things are not going well, and he senses it's the end. Things are falling apart. And he dies. And then his body is humiliated by these people. This is not good. But the end of that chapter, chapter 10, it says, so Saul died for his breach of faith. Saul was a mighty man. He got chosen to be king because he was a mighty man. He was taken out of all the mighty men and made the top, the chief, the king. And at that point, it says, Saul died for his breach of faith. Saul didn't die because of strategy and tactics on the battlefield. He died because of his breach of faith with his Lord. He broke faith with the Lord, and that he did not keep the command of the Lord, and also consulted a medium, seeking guidance. He did not seek guidance from the Lord. Therefore, the Lord put him to death and turned the kingdom over to David. Mighty men sandwiched between two battles. This battle is Saul's. The second battle is David's. David's battle goes differently. While the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, this is later, by the way, once David's now been made king over Israel, as you just heard, all the Philistines went up to search for David. They just killed Saul. They're looking at it and saying, all right, they got a new king. Let's go take him out. Let's deal with this riffraff. So the Philistines are going, no sweat, we're going to take him down. So they go after him. But David heard of it and he went out against them. Now the Philistines had come and made a raid in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of God, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand? And the Lord said, go up and I will give them into your hand. And he went up and David struck them down there. And David said, God has broken through my enemies by my hand like a bursting flood. Philistines came yet again. And they made a raid in the valley, and David again inquired of God. And God said to him, you shall not go up after them. Go around and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then go out to the battle, for God has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines. And David did as God commanded him. And they struck down the Philistine army from Gibeon to Gezer. And the fame of David went out into all the lands. And the Lord brought the fear of him upon all nations. Two battles. Mighty men in the middle. One turns out very badly. One turns out really good. The one that turns out badly was a man who sought guidance from others, but didn't seek the guidance of the Lord. The one that turned out well was a man who inquired of God before he went through. It's that simple. Mighty men, doesn't much matter how mighty you are. Saul was bigger, badder, tougher than David. But David held the day that day. What happens there? Two battlefields. Most of the time what happens is who we're listening to, who we're following. I like to refer to them as two captains. And these captains are in your life. The first captain is the one where you come along and it's somebody who is you want to follow a confident leader. How many of you want a confident leader? You ever seen somebody who's afraid to lead, who's hesitant to make a decision? Does that not just frustrate you? You're going, come on, make a decision, any decision. It doesn't even have to be the right one. We'll at least know then that you're an idiot. Have you not felt that way? Have you not sometimes been that way? The reality is that we need confident leaders. The problem is that first leader is the one that's confident and does things that he doesn't have no clue what he's doing. And he charges through in his own confidence and his own strength, and he thinks, I can pull this off. Doesn't much matter. The second captain is one that's confident because he does know what he's doing. In fact, he's been there before and he's confident about what lays ahead. So back to my son, the first confident leader. He's going into a home of insurgents in Iraq, and they've pinpointed this place 2-3 in the morning when everybody's sleeping, sound asleep. They break down the door. They come in to capture these guys. The room is filled with nothing but bad guys. And they come in, the Rangers storm in, and most of the time when they go do this, there's not a shot that gets fired because they strike so quick and so fast and they overwhelm the enemy that usually they don't even have to pull the trigger. It's just in and out. They get the guys they need and they get out of there, which is a good thing because it's usually like a beehive. Once you do that, then the whole place kind of kicks with a bunch of enemy. His job, again, as a fire support officer, is because he's got the radio, he's got to be at a point that's a vantage point to be able to see others. So he always goes up on the roof. They go into this house. They go through the rooms. Once the house is cleared, he goes up on the roof. So that way he can see if other people are coming. He can call in support. He can get help there if needed. He's up on the roof. His guys are doing what they need to down below. They capture the guys they want. They handcuff them. They take them, and they get out of there. And so Noel's up on the roof and he's looking and he sees a group of guys going away from the house. And they go down the street to the corner and they turn the corner and they head out. And just as they're turning the corner, he's looking at them and he says, "Man, they look a lot like my guys." Commanded radio silence unless there's something going down. He can't even get on the radio to talk to him to see exactly what's happening. And he's sitting there and he's realizing, that's my unit. They just left. But all they did was capture the two guys they needed. The others are downstairs and not happy about being woken up at 2 and 3 in the morning, as you can imagine. And he's left alone on the roof. Now, we could tell that story some other day. My point of the story is about the captain. And here's a captain who's confident about what he's doing, and he just goes in. No, what happened is he comes downstairs and he realizes, I'm toast. I am literally toast. I'm not going to get in a firefight with these guys because I am going to lose that one. I've got one choice, and that is just to simply bolt in and bolt out. So he simply comes into the room hard and fast. Well, these guys are kind of stunned by what's happened already, and they're starting to settle down. Their adrenaline's going down. Everything's kind of calming down. And all of a sudden, when they think they're alone, one more Ranger shows up from out of nowhere. They're scared again of him. And so they all jump back, and he knows that's his moment. And so he bolts through the room. He goes towards the door, and there's one huge guy, one big insurgent right at the door, and he's just looking at him. And my son says, "I didn't know what to do, but I needed to get out that door. So I ran right to him. I grabbed him and just threw him against the wall and was out the door and took off down the street." And he gets out of there by the skin of his teeth. Now, I personally want to know who that captain was, because I look at it and say, my son could have died that day. Because of the confidence of that captain, everything's okay. We know what we're doing. We're going down the road. But he didn't know that everything was okay. He didn't even know where his men were. You guys know how important that is. If you're going to be in that position and follow a captain, you want to know that he is confident, but you also want to know that he knows everything. You want to know that he knows where you are and that he cares about you. You want to know that he's concerned about not only what's next, but what just happened and why and where they're headed. The second captain that my son encountered was when he was going through Ranger training. He got to a point where it was the last thing where they do this forced march, and it's like 65 pounds, 70 pounds you got to carry with you, full guns, weapons, all that kind of stuff, all the gear, and you've got to march, I don't remember the actual mileage, but some insane amount of mileage. Enough so that at least two guys broke their legs on the hike. That's how hard they have to march in a limited amount of time. And my son said, "I don't know that I can make this." So his goal, he told us, he said, "The way I made it was I figured the captain that was leading the hike was part of the training battalion. He had done this over and over. And he said, this guy knows what to do. He's done this course before. He knows how to pace it. I'm going to stay on his heels. That whatever he does, if he stops to get a drink, I'm going to get a drink. If he heads up faster up the hill, I'm going to head up faster up the hill. If he takes a break here and there, I'm going to take a break here and there. Wherever he goes, I'm going to stay right on his heels." And by the end, my son was one of 16. Because he followed that logic of following a leader that was confident. Why was he confident? Because that leader had done it so many times before. He knew what was coming up next. Now, if you don't see the spiritual analogy by there, it's the idea of, do you do it because you're the captain of your life? You feel pretty confident about your life? you pretty much know what's coming next, don't you? Or do you follow a captain that really does know what's coming next? He knows what's around the corner. That's the one you want to stay on the heels of. The other one you don't want to trust. That makes perfect sense when you tell a story like this. It doesn't make so much sense when it's our life. Because then we look at our life and go, no. You want me to surrender control of my life to who? And that's where we wrestle with. Not just in a first decision whether we want to trust God, but it's a decision that we have to make constantly. I need to read to you a quote from Alistair Begg. And I don't know how many of you guys have ever heard Alistair Begg, but he's one of my favorite preachers right now. And he says this: there has never been a time when the resources of the church in North America have been more phenomenal than they are right now. The resources of the church are huge right now. There's never been a time when it's been greater. But it is definitely questionable whether there is any direct correlation between our resources and our actual impact on culture. You ever thought about that? That our churches are bigger, they're more equipped, whether it's from video and sound and talented people and publishing and curriculum for Sunday school, and the staffs are bigger than they've ever been before. Our churches are very, very well equipped with resources. But meanwhile, you look at our culture and you begin to wonder, are we making much of an impact at all? We wrestle with that. We're so well equipped, and yet there doesn't seem to be much proportion, direct proportion to what's happening. So he says that it's definitely questionable whether there's any direct correlation between our resources and our impact on the culture, causing me at least to ponder the question, perhaps we've got it completely upside down. Maybe the emphasis ought not to be on our resources that we've been able to produce, but maybe our emphasis ought to be on the fact of our inadequacy. Maybe the emphasis ought to be on the fact of our inadequacy, thereby looking to God alone to provide the resources for us. But of course, until we've determined that that is exactly the case, then we will continue to rely on our own strength. I think he's right. I think the issue that is, as long as we feel like we're equipped, that we have our resources, that we're capable and that we're able, as long as we feel that way, we're never going to depend on God. And until we feel inadequate, we won't turn to God. David knew this. David, who fought the second battle, as we look at it in 1 Samuel, when he takes on Goliath, you guys know that story? David and Goliath. David says this when he comes up against this huge giant. The armies are arrayed in the valley. He comes up, little tiny David, just comes from being a shepherd, and he shows up with his little slingshot and 5 stones. You remember that moment. David says this to the giant: you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. It's not the resources, it's not your sword and spear. It's not your strength, it's not your intelligence, and clearly I can look at some of you and say it's not your good looks. All those things you have that you think are going for you, David gets it. He says, that's not going to do it. But what happens next, it's going to happen because of God, so that everybody knows that he is the Lord. Not because you did it well, because the only way it could happen is that God did it. Our strength isn't in our resource. Our strength is in our inadequacy. It's in our weakness. It's in our humility. David got that. John the Baptist got that. John the Baptist stops and says, when his disciples are talking about it, they're coming up to John the Baptist and they're going, who's this Jesus guy? And John says, he must increase and I must decrease. Why are we always wanting to pump ourselves up? What we need to do is deflate ourselves and pump him up. That's what this is about. David knew it. John the Baptist knew it. Even Christ himself knew it. Christ says, apart from the Father, I am nothing. I can't do this without my own Father. And if Christ can't do it, why do you think you can? It's a troubling thing. There's a statement Alistair Begg makes about the Pharisees. You know the Pharisees, they're the teachers of the law. They were the ones in Israel that everybody knew. They kind of heralded themselves of who was the wisest, who was the smartest, and they would kind of set themselves up, always making sure that they look good to everybody else. Alistair Begg says about the Pharisees, they got to the point that everyone knew them. Everyone knew the Pharisees. Everyone knew them, but no one knew their God. Is that true of you? At a point that you've pumped yourself up, lifted yourself up, you've carried this persona about you so well that everybody knows you. Your name goes before you, but no one knows your God. Does that trouble you? It troubles me because I constantly do this. I constantly pump myself up. I constantly try to put myself in the best light. I constantly want to make the stories come out on my side that favor me. And yet by doing that, I obscure my own Savior. The reality is I'm nothing apart from Him, and I need Him in this. All right. There's two problems. I kind of narrowed it down this way. There are two problems with this. Number one, the most common that we do, is that we measure our resources and determine that we really don't need God. We get up in the morning, we think, I'm good for the day. I know what my agenda is. I know what I've got to do. And I'm good for it, and I go do it. So the first problem is that we measure our resources and determine that we're good. I got to ask you a question. When's the last time you woke up in the morning and said, you know what, I don't know. I don't think I can do this day. Lord, I don't think I can face what's about to happen to me. I need your help, Lord. And I mean this question honestly. Stop and reflect on this for a second. When was the last time that when you got out of bed, you couldn't start your day until you'd met with your Savior? Because you feel pretty confident. You know exactly what's around the corner. Remember that first captain? You don't know what a day holds. This last week, a friend of mine, Scott, got some achiness in his back. He finally went to the doctor, and he went to the doctor. The doctor says, you have an extremely aggressive form of cancer. You've got 3 weeks. You think Scott got up that morning and said, I think today is the day that I'm going to get the word that I've got 3 weeks to live. Lord, I'm going to need you for this day. No, he didn't. When was the last time that you couldn't start the day until you had already met with God? If you're in that position and you've got problem number one, you tend to look at it and say, I've measured my resources and I'm pretty much sure I can take care of what's about to happen to me today. I don't need him. That's a tough one. The second problem is that you've measured your resources and determined that you don't have enough and it's too risky, so you're not going to follow God. And there's a troubling question there as well. That God's been talking to some of you about what he wants you to do as an act of obedience. Even now, your heart starts to beat a little faster because the Spirit of God does this. He comes into our lives, and I'll do this. Will this cause feedback if I go out here? God comes up, and he says, I need you. I need you to do this thing. How many of you have heard that voice? How many know that God calls you to act in obedience, and you put it off? Sometimes he's telling you to go talk to a friend, talk to a fellow worker, talk to a neighbor. Sometimes it's to talk to your wife and say, I'm sorry, or your husband. God's calling you to do something. Your pride says, no, I can't do that. I don't do that. That's risky. She may say this. He may say this. This may turn out this way or that. So the second problem is we measure our resource and determine it's not enough. It's a lack of faith. That's why Saul died, by the way. Because he broke faith, he didn't trust God anymore, and he started asking other people. These two problems are ones that conflict all of us. That we come into the issue, we measure the resource, we either determine that we have too much and we don't need God, or we don't have enough that God's not going to carry through. Faith in the right resource isn't there. Our focus should be on our inadequacy. Okay, last story about mighty men is out of the same passage, tucked in the middle. As David's battle, or Saul's battle on Mount Gilboa goes so poorly, the battle rages, Saul loses. He dies on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines take over this valley. They move in. Meanwhile, Israel is in disarray. They've lost their king. They're in trouble. So they all go to David and they say, David, mighty David, we need you now. Yeah, where were they before? But now suddenly they need David. So it comes in and it lists all the mighty men that show up at David's house. Basically, they come to the door and go, hey, we were with this other guy, but he's dead now. So we'd like to be with you. We need you to stand. We need you to fight. We want to stand next to you, side by side with you. And then comes this list in Chronicles, this list of the tribes of Israel that show up. Some with 6,000, some with 4,000, 7,000, 4,600 the Levites, 3,700 from the Prince of Jehoiada and the House of Aaron, the Benjaminites, 3,000 of the Ephraimites, 20,800 men. And it says some of them that they were these men were all skilled with a sword. These men were all fantastic archers. And it goes on and talks about how great these guys are. And then tucked in the middle of this list is this verse. Of the men of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times and knew what Israel must do, 200. Everybody's got thousands and tens of thousands, skilled warriors, except for the men of Issachar. They've got 200. 200 men show up from the men of Issachar. We're here to save the day, say all the rest. We've brought our resources with us. We are the mighty men. We're ready to take it on. That's a good thing. The last thing you should do when you hear about this is go, oh, well, I shouldn't rely on my resources and I'm going to just let my body go. I'm going to let my mind go. I'm not going to use the gifts God gave me. These guys that show up with their troops are a good thing. But there's a great picture here tucked between these two battles of somebody who relies on his own strength and somebody who relies only on God. And in the middle, all these people show up with their warriors, except for the men of Issachar. They send 200 chiefs. These are the men who understood the times and knew what Israel must do. They were different. Do you know why they knew what Israel must do? I don't. It doesn't actually say anything other than that. It's a single verse. It says just that. But as I've studied the passage and looked at it, I've come to a point where there's a different part in this where I went back and I thought, well, these people are coming from all over. David's down in Hebron, southern Israel. Where are the people from Issachar? Where do they live? Do you know where they live? They live in the Valley of Jezreel. That's helpful, isn't it? Where's the Valley of Jezreel? It's where all the Philistines moved in after they killed David, or Saul. It's at the base of Mount Gilboa. In other words, the men of Issachar were there that day. They watched that battle. They watched the whole thing go down. They watched everybody run away in the time of trouble. They stayed because it was their families. The Philistines moved in. You want to talk about somebody who understands the times? It's the people who are occupied with the enemy. They're living face to face with him. These guys show up a little bit humbled. They'd seen their king die. They'd seen everybody flee. They have the enemy living in their midst. They know about inadequacy. They don't show up with their army. My guess is because their army was still trying to guard their wife and kids back home. It's all conjecture. We don't know much more than this verse. But the bottom line is, tucked between two battlefields is a group of people who didn't show up with resource. Instead, it says they understood the times and knew what Israel must do. How did they know? They'd watched it happen. They knew what was next, and they knew they shouldn't trust in themselves. They knew that they needed to trust in God. And they show up to battle and go with David out to battle. And David, before he goes to battle, stops and says, I will inquire of the Lord what I should do. David's first battle, Lord, should I do this battle? God says, yeah, go do it. So he goes and he wins it on his resources, on his strategy, and he wins the battle. The second battle, David's ready with his resources. God, should I do this? And God says, no, don't do it. Don't go that way this time. You need to sneak around behind him because in the balsam trees is a huge army. Go around behind. What would have happened if he would have attacked? Well, the guys in the balsam trees, they were setting up an ambush. Had David trusted his own resources, it would have destroyed him. This issue of trusting your resources is us. Again and again, it is us. Last part of the story of my son comes down with what happened as he was getting out of the army. He had two kids, twin babies, and they got to be about 7 months old. And when they were 7 months old, he had just come back from Iraq. He was home in Savannah, Georgia, where the 1st Ranger Battalion is stationed. And as he's there, they go to bed one night. And middle of the night, one of the babies wakes up crying. So they go to check on the one twin baby, 7 months old. They find her name's Avery, standing on Asher, the boy. And Asher's not breathing. Now, some of you have been in those situations. My son trained as a ranger. They train you in first aid, CPR, all that kind of stuff, because you're likely to have to help somebody. So my son writes this letter. This letter is a letter from my oldest son, Noel, to my youngest son, Edward. And he writes this in the letter. He says, "Edward, always remember that God is with you, even when you cannot feel him. I remember the night that he took Asher to be with him. I had never been so afraid as when I spent 11 minutes trying to save Asher before the ambulance arrived. I did not feel God's presence. I felt angry. I felt lost and confused. I still don't understand why God has chosen to put me through this loss. I think this is the most important thing that I can pass on to you, though. I believe that God loves us all. He knows what is best, and he is always right by your side. Follow him, and he will take you where you need to go." That's a U.S. Army Ranger. It's confident to do anything he wants to do, anytime, anywhere. I won't mess with him anymore, that's for sure. He has the resources. But that night, he had nothing. He could not do it. And if anybody's seen that happen in life after life, it's you men and women. The issue is that happening in your life right now? Are you at a position of inadequacy, or are you still at a point of feeling quite confident that you can handle what this life is throwing at you? I want to finish just simply with a couple of stories of men like John White. Those of you who know John White, has there not been a time when he asks more about you than you can ask about him? Have you ever noticed that? You can't find out about what's happening on in John White's life. He's always thinking about you. He's always praying for you. He's always investing in you. They are so incredible in their ministry and their prayers for you. A point of inadequacy. He comes on as a mighty man, and he serves others. This whole thing, Alistair Begg says, is upside down. It's the world that's upside down. It's God that's actually got it right side up. And it's that we should be servants. I find myself surrounded by mighty men who get this. I've got a friend named John Alvarado, a young man, very talented, could do anything in just about any church in America, get a great salary. He chooses instead to go work for a ministry that he launches called Reflect Ministries down in Tijuana, Mexico. And he drives down there and works with kids down there for no money at all, just hoping that God might actually stir the hearts of people to give along the way. It's pretty much exposed there, a point of inadequacy. And he does that. And we could go on stories. Some of you may know Chris Simney. He's a great speaker, one of our best speakers. Chris, when he's a young man in his teens, he gets crippled by a debilitating disease. It puts him in a wheelchair. He can't walk. He can't talk. He's got to use he gets a colostomy, and his life is just a mess. And he rebuilds his life, gives it to the Lord, and says, "Lord, I will use this any way you need me to use." So even now, if Chris were on the stage, those of you who don't know him, he would have to use all his energy possible just to talk. When you see him speak, his neck strains with the effort he has to use just to get words out so that you can hear him. But when he speaks at Hume, you can hear a pin drop. Not because they can't understand him, but because this is a man who has seen his point of inadequacy and says, "I can't do this, but I've come in contact with a God who can." And when you meet those people who've come in contact with God, then God shines through. Remember the Pharisees? Everybody knows their name. We don't know who their God is. You want to see a mighty man? The mighty man of God is the one who, when you see him, you don't see him. You see his God. Because he allows his God to work in his life. And I can't think of any more fitting way than to end on just that point. To stop and say, you men are mighty men. I respect you. I love you. I am so thrilled that you are here. And wives, whether you're either a firefighter yourself or whether you're just a part of this community and the support you give to your husband, we're all in the same boat. This could be a talk to plumbers. Because our pride always gets there, our resource, we think we can make it on our own. And we need to come to a point to where we don't act unless we've inquired of God. We need him in our life. We need him as our captain. We need to cash out on our own strength. Here's the hard part. I'm not going to let you off the hook. Some of you right now are stuck in this point where you look at it and say, you know what, I can't turn to God. I don't even know who he is. Some of you are at that point where you're thinking, you know what, I keep hearing God calling out to me, but man, that just scares me. I don't know if I want to surrender to that. One quick passage. Everybody's heard the verse John 3:16. A couple verses just after it. The John 3:16 part is a part where it talks about the fact that we've all sinned. We've all messed up our lives. But the tail end of it, as it talks about it, it talks about the fact that God so loved us that he sent his son to die for us. Do you know what that sounds like when Christ does that? It sounds like a point of inadequacy. You know what that means? That Christ at that point doesn't depend on his resources to get him through the next part. In fact, as he's praying just before he gets hung on a cross, he stops and says, Father, not my will, but yours be done. And he ends up getting nailed to a cross so that his blood would be covered as a sacrifice so that our sins would be forgiven. At that point, when he surrenders his will and says, Father, your will be done, this is pretty inadequate. How powerful do you think Jesus feels right then? You know the song, he could have called down 10,000 angels. And sometimes you'd wish he would have, just to zap them all, except that we'd been missing in our salvation. But instead, he surrenders his strength, and in weakness, we've been healed. The story of this is the gospel.
May be near or far. that you're a Christian, don't be ashamed to bear his name. Oh, tell the world that you're a Christian and take him with you
together again. You heard.